entitled Let's Choose Heaven Here. Ms. Curtis will be introduced by Mr. Ray Fullerton.
Today, our lecturers, members of the Board of Lectorship of the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts, carry out Jesus' instruction for the benefit of all who wish to listen. Our lecturer has the distinguishing capability and the enriching experience of a teacher and practitioner of Christian Science. She has traveled throughout all the world for the Mother Church as an assistant manager of branches and practitioners. She has served as a first reader in her branch church, and she has devotedly served in many other capacities in the unfoldment of Christian Science. Before entering into the full-time practice, she was a brilliant concert pianist. The title of her lecture is Let's Choose Heaven Here. Our lecturer is Miss Grace Demas Curtis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fullerton, and good evening. I wonder if any one of you here tonight ever felt like a man did who came up to speak with me after a lecture last year. He referred to a statement I'd made in the lecture about the ultimate meaning of life. And he said, now that's what I'm looking for. Meaning in life. He said to me, life doesn't have any meaning at all. It's just eat, drink, grab all you can and die. But he went on, if I could find that there is a basic meaning in life, a real reason for living, I'd be the happiest man in the world. Why, he said, that would be heaven. Well, he raised a pretty fundamental question, didn't he? It's a question we've all asked ourselves occasionally, and sometimes repeatedly. What's it all about? Are we just accidental entities occupying a moment of time on the way to extinction? That's the material view of life he held. Or are we beings capable of spiritual awareness, fulfillment, and satisfaction? Well, we all want the answer to that question, don't we? We all want to know we have a vital purpose, because as that longing is satisfied, we can begin to choose heaven. But instead of having this confidence and assurance, many people today are deeply disturbed, because life seems to them to be mechanical and meaningless. The development of technology, at the expense of the development of spirituality, has brought to this age great material ease and equally great mental malaise, a conviction that something's wrong and must be corrected. Thus, many people today are protesting a mechanized society that makes them feel trapped in futility without realizing that what they're really seeking, like that man at the lecture, is the spiritual meaning of life. But instead of this, an incredible infatuation with material things and with a sheerly economic point of view has obsessed us. And this neglect of spiritual values has engendered the mental climate that causes this period to be aptly named the Age of Anxiety. But there is a way out of our dark bewilderment, a way each one of us can find and choose to follow. The prophet Isaiah said, "An highway shall be there, and a way. And it shall be called the way of holiness, of wholeness, completeness, meaning." Now here's the hint of purpose, an eternal purpose, a way through anxiety's wilderness, out of the smog of material beliefs and unhappiness, into a clear and beautiful atmosphere of spiritual harmony. Into what that man at the lecture must have been looking for when he said, that would be heaven. But this is a way that has to be chosen individually and specifically. Then the question inevitably arises, how do we know this is the way to choose? When I was in my teens, I used to ask myself that question. And one day the answer came to me something like this. I thought, suppose I were lost in a vast forest. I'd struggled hopelessly about trying to find my way out when suddenly I came on a faint trail. Well, you can imagine I hurried along it until it forked and became two paths going in opposite directions. As I stood there hesitating, wondering which one to follow, I looked down one of the paths. And there, almost hidden in the bushes, I saw a battered, worn old sign with the words, Dead End, written on it. Suppose you were there right now. Which path would you choose? The one marked Dead End or the other one? You'd choose the other one, wouldn't you? Even if you didn't know exactly where it went. I thought matter, material living, has Dead End written all over it. I'll choose the spiritual path that promises to go somewhere. Well, you know, we all have that choice to make. One way or another, each one of us chooses between matter and spirit. If we don't actively choose the spiritual way, then we've passively chosen the material. So a choice we all make, whether we think we do or not, and we make that choice over and over every day. Look down the path of material existence with me for a minute. What do you see? Down through the ages, mankind struggling and striving for four things. For wealth, power, popularity, and family ties. And with all their struggle, they still have poverty, conflict, injustice, and frustration. Now look down the spiritual path. There we see individuals who have found spiritual substance meeting all their daily needs, and in addition, they've gained a lasting sense of justice, peace, and satisfaction. Well, this spiritual path is the one presented by Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, in her book, Science and Health, with Key to the Scriptures, where she writes, For right reasoning, there should be but one fact before the thought, namely, spiritual existence. And for right choosing, for choosing a life with heavenly meaning, we need to keep the same one fact before our thought, spiritual existence. But what if we don't know how to do this? We've become weary with the perplexities and frustrations of that search for material wealth, power, popularity, and family ties. We long for spiritual peace, goodness, and love, but we're not sure how to follow this path. But we can be helped and guided by considering the examples of some who've chosen to walk this way before us. Four spiritually minded people in history seem to me to show most clearly how the choice is made. Their lives show us that there are four timeless, essential qualities that speed us along the spiritual way. These are mental flexibility, moral courage, total selflessness, and universal love. They expressed these qualities humanly, but in varying degrees they understood the deep spiritual source in which these qualities are based. And their lives show us how, by following the way of spirit, we can have heaven instead of hell right here. So because their lives point the way for us, let's see what we can learn from their experience. Let's consider first a very wealthy and important man who knew how to change his mind. That is, he had an open, spiritually receptive thought, mental flexibility. Now you might think that his wealth and business success would have satisfied him, but they didn't. He felt life held something better, more enduring. But he didn't know what it was nor where to find it. So this man, Abraham, left his comfortable material way of life in the city of Ur to follow the spiritual path and find God. Now the archaeologists tell us that Ur was a rich, sophisticated city. So Abraham was no simple herdsman. He was the product of the richest, highest culture of that period. Yet he looked for something better than it afforded him. The Bible says he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now Abraham had that choice we're talking about. He could follow his old ways of thinking, or he could think through to an entirely new purpose in life. And he made his choice. He willingly left the security of his customary habits of thought and went into a mental and physical wilderness to find spiritual truth. Now, he'd been brought up to believe in many gods and in human sacrifice as the way to worship them. But in his mental struggle, he came to see that there is one almighty God, Spirit, the source of life, to be worshipped by living, not dying. Well, Abraham immediately turned away from his false theological concepts and accepted this new view of life as wholly spiritual. He went on to see that spiritual ideas are real wealth, substance, and security. Did this make him a poor man materially? No, it didn't. On the contrary, his recognition of spiritual substance brought him wealth of every kind. In fact, Abraham was so abundantly blessed, his name has stood through four millennia as a man who changed his basis of thought and life from matter to spirit, and who found enduring substance, wealth, security. But now let's consider a man who didn't change so quickly and easily, but who held fast to spiritual light once he had accepted it. Long after Abraham, this man lived in the richest, most cultured, and powerful civilization of his time. Historians tell us that Moses was educated as a pharaoh of Egypt. Now that was the highest position of power in that period. So Moses was trained as a personal leader. He was taught to believe that his exalted position gave him power, and that he could use this power as he wished. Now, Moses knew that there was a nation enslaved in Egypt. He wanted to help them. But the only power he knew was physical force. So, in a mistaken attempt to do good, he misused this power and had to flee into the desolate wilderness. It was there, in lonely darkness and doubt, that spiritual ideas began to dawn on him. Gradually, he saw that physical force, however courageously used, cannot and does not solve the problems of human life. But because he had much to unlearn, Moses was a long time in his mental wilderness, turning away from the material to the spiritual. Gradually he saw that Spirit, God, is one omnipotent mind or ego, the great I Am, the source of identity and power. Now this term, I Am, by which Moses identified God, is defined in Science and Health as follows. I Am, God, incorporeal and eternal mind, divine principle, the only ego. And Christian Science also teaches that individual identity is derived from this one omnipotent mind or ego, and that it's expressed humanly in intelligence, ability, and dominion over evil. Well, that's what discerning the divine I Am did for Moses. He didn't become weak after he became humble enough to admit that God is the only power. In fact, his adherence to this true source of identity and power gave him spiritual strength such as he had never had before. Brute physical courage was replaced by moral courage. Courage based not on muscle or personal authority, but on the deep truths of spiritual being that Moses had begun to grasp. Well, now he'd gained sufficient moral courage to return to Egypt and to challenge Pharaoh from a spiritual basis this time to set free the enslaved people. Well, you can imagine Pharaoh resisted. But through repeated demonstrations of spiritual power, Moses forced him to set free an entire nation. And after this tremendous accomplishment, Moses needed even greater spiritual steadfastness, because now he had an undisciplined mass of humanity on his hands. They were so steeped in materialism, they didn't know how to govern themselves. But Moses had learned that real freedom is attained only through moral and spiritual self-discipline. So he guided them through the wilderness of their dense materialism until he had awakened them to a sufficient sense of moral and spiritual law to found a free and independent nation. Well, Abraham saw that Spirit is the real source of wealth or substance. And Moses discerned that Spirit is the real source of power and dominion. Now let's consider a man who saw that Spirit is the real source of identity and selfhood. A man who yielded every vestige of a material personality for a life wholly spiritual in its meaning and intent. Centuries after Moses, this man lived in humble circumstances. Yet he was endowed with great personal charm and attraction, great charisma. Now he knew that this could bring him the adulation of the world. And he was tempted to consider the possibility of achieving such personal popularity. But notice this. Like Abraham and Moses before him, Jesus went into the wilderness to make his choice between matter and spirit, between himself as a physical personality and himself as an individual expression of divine being. Whereas Moses had spent 40 years in the wilderness, purging himself from a material and personal sense of existence, Jesus needed to spend only 40 days. The book of Hebrews says he was in all points tempted, like as we are, yet without sin. In the beautiful imagery of the Bible, we read of Jesus' temptation. Then the devil taketh him up into an exceeding high mountain, and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world, and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me, worship material existence. Well, Jesus made his choice at once. He refused what lesser men cling to, their small-minded sense of good as a personal possession. Jesus refused to claim good as personal, separate from the good which is God. So he immediately replied to the evil suggestion, "Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve." And with this mighty statement, Jesus refused forever ephemeral personal good and chose the permanent selfhood and glory of spirit. And that was the end of Jesus' temptation to accept the claim that good can be contained in a physical personality. And it was the beginning of the greatest life and ministry the world has ever known. Jesus not only chose to serve God, he identified himself completely with the divine source and principle of existence. As a result, Jesus, the individual human man, was always governed in everything he said and did by the eternal Christ. The Christ, the complete expression and true idea of God, constituted his very nature and selfhood. Now Jesus fully exemplified man's spiritual substance and spiritual dominion that Abraham and Moses had earlier glimpsed. But it remained for Jesus to show forth the fullness of the Christ. He identified himself with spirit so completely. He refused matter so finally that he had total control over material conditions. He healed the sick and revived the dead, proving forever the permanent reality and power of spirit, and the consequent unreality and powerlessness of material resistance. Jesus taught that spirit, God, is truth, and men must know truth. He taught that God is love, and men must live love. His mighty example of selfless dominion, and that's the eternal Christ power, is the spiritual way mapped out for us in a human life. It's the way we all must follow out of matter into spirit, the way to heaven. But Jesus' glorious example was soon misunderstood and misinterpreted by the world's materialists, until even the church allowed materialism to dominate it. Jesus knew this was likely to happen. He knew the world didn't understand his spiritual example. So he promised that the truth he taught and the love he lived would be more fully explained at some future period than all the world could understand and exercise the selfless spiritual dominion over material conditions that he had taught. About 1800 years later, this further explanation came. A woman left precious family ties and loving friends and went into the wilderness to find the divine relationship. She looked for a more spiritual sense of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, expressed in universal love. Mary Baker Eddy's constant desire to know and obey God was the dominant factor in her life, and to this end she studied the Bible eagerly. In her autobiography, Retrospection and Introspection, she writes, "From my very childhood I was impelled by a hunger and thirst after divine things, a desire for something higher and better than matter, and apart from it, to seek diligently for the knowledge of God as the one great and ever-present relief from human woe." Well, she was rejected by her family and friends in her search for truth. Over many weary years, one material support after another failed her. Finally, like those others I've spoken of, she completely repudiated reliance on matter. In the darkest hour, when the total meaninglessness of matter became apparent to her, her lifelong search was rewarded. An understanding of the allness of spiritual good dawned on her thought. Now, the absolute allness of spirit implies the utter nothingness of matter. And a conviction of these two points is cardinal to the spiritual science Mrs. Eddy discovered. It differentiates Christian science from all other ways of thinking. These premises set it apart from mental methods that rely upon the physical brain and material personality as the source of intelligence, instead of relying on the infinite mind, God. I'm sure most of you here tonight know that in Christian science, the word mind, spelled with a capital M, always refers to God, the divine principle of spiritual being. Well, Mrs. Eddy didn't stop with her discovery. Out of her great love for humanity, she devoted the rest of her long human life to sharing her discovery with all men. She named it Christian Science, and she taught how its principle, divine love, can be applied to meet all human needs with the unfailing universality of scientific law. Now, the totally spiritual basis of this law of universal love is set forth in Science and Health in Mrs. Eddy's epitome of Christian science, known as the Scientific Statement of Being. And this is a statement every Christian scientist knows. There is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation. For God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth. Matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material, he is spiritual. Well, this statement is the complete expression of the spiritual way, the highway of Isaiah. Through mental flexibility, Abraham glimpsed the spiritual way. He saw that spirit is substance and life, and this solved his personal problems. With moral courage, Moses followed the spiritual way after he discerned that spirit, God, is one omnipotent mind or soul, the source of identity and power. And this led a nation to freedom. Jesus, through his total rejection of personal good and his completely selfless demonstration of spiritual truth and love, made the way of the Christ available to all humanity. And with universal love, Mrs. Eddy discerned that spirit is the principle of all true being. She explained the science of the Christ so that all the world can choose the spiritual way, understand it, and begin to apply the abundant blessings of heaven in their daily lives. But is this spiritual way really practical in our modern world? Can we choose heaven here? We can indeed. I'd like to tell you about a very modern young man who came to see me one day. He was a dropout from the world and miserably unhappy because the first words he said to me were, "I don't know why I've come to see you unless it's to discuss suicide." Well, he was a brilliant fellow. He'd studied extensively in materialistic psychology, sociology, and philosophy until he had become convinced that man is just a physical mechanism, operating on conditioned reflexes and ending in utter futility. As he said, life isn't worth living as a cog in a machine. I asked him, if you knew that there is a sure way out of existential futility, drugs, materialism, and suicide, would you take it? Why, yes, he said, I would, but there's no such way. I insisted, but are you willing to try such a way if you're assured that it exists? Well, we had a long talk about the spiritual way, much as we've talked about it here tonight. When he left, he remarked doubtfully, well, maybe it's worth a gamble. I asked him to drop all other reading. He read all the time. And to read Science and Health through. Then I turned my thought to the universal law of divine love. Well, he came back at the end of a week, having read the book through. He said, it's a very nice theory. But 10 days later, he was back again, after a second reading. This time he said, you know, it's really a great idea. I could only be sure it's true. 2 weeks more. A third reading. And he came again. This time he had a light in his eye. He said, I want you to know I'm going to try it. Well, all this time he'd been learning something about spiritual substance, spiritual identity, and the Christ power available to all. So I wasn't surprised when, not too long ago, I received a letter from him. I'd like to read a few lines from it. Life is great. Christian Science has shown me what it's all about, where I'm headed, and how to get there. There really is a way out of hell into heaven. I'm glad I found it. Well, if this spiritual way and method is so readily available, why is there so much sorrow and suffering, so much hell all around us? The answer is pollution. Mental pollution. Now, you all know what pollution is because you hear about it all the time. The news media is full of air pollution, water pollution, food pollution, noise pollution. But they don't say much about mental pollution. And that's the most important to understand. Pure air and pure water become polluted when waste products are poured into them. Just so. When the waste products of material thinking, such as fear, resentment, greed, lust, lack, hate, violence, conflict, sin, disease, and death, pour unchecked into our thinking and then into our lives, our thought becomes so clogged with this mental pollution, we don't recognize clear, true spiritual ideas. We don't even see the spiritual facts. So we don't think along spiritual lines. And then our inharmonious experience expresses the smog of our thinking. Now, none of us would intentionally eat contaminated food or drink contaminated water. But most of us willingly think contaminated thoughts. The same fastidious people who wouldn't allow a drop of contaminated food to touch their lips open their thinking wide to a steady diet of lurid mental muck. Oh, yes. We all do it. Has social expediency ever caused you to go along with or even participate in dismal, depressing conversations about disease, disaster, discord, and death? Has idle habit ever kept you glued to television's drug-oriented advertising and constant crude violence? Has sensationalism ever lured you into reading at length about horrendous crimes, abnormalities, and catastrophes? Has morbid curiosity ever enticed you into loading your thinking with the vilest filth commercialism can contrive? Then, with thought thus heavily polluted, is it any wonder that life seems so bleak and grim and the world so hopeless? We're told that when material waste ceases to be poured into air and water, its dire effects can be eliminated. Just so. When we cease to allow the waste products of material thinking to flood our mental homes, our consciousness purges itself. We become aware of spiritual facts. We think along spiritual lines, and our lives function normally and harmoniously. Well, you may say, the problem is much more than just what I think. So it is. But your individual experience becomes one of heaven or hell according to your individual choice. How can this be? Well, you see, heaven isn't a locality to be found in the future. It's a completely spiritual, harmonious state of thought and experience both here and hereafter. Just as hell isn't a locality either. It's completely polluted thinking and living also here and hereafter. And a lot of people are living in it right here. Where do you want to live? The choice is yours to make here and now. We can accept the pollution and the unhappiness resulting from materially based thinking. Or we can choose to think from a wholly spiritual basis and enjoy the clear, pure, invigorating atmosphere of heaven. And then we can share this heavenly atmosphere with all men. Well, it's easy to see the problem, and even to see the solution. But the process of putting the solution into practice is the important thing, isn't it? So how do we choose heaven here? Well, let's let our four examples show us how. You remember Abraham was dissatisfied with his way of life. He felt there must be something better. So he willingly left his customary habits of thought to find it. I'm going to say that over again. He willingly left his customary habits of thought to find it. As we've said, he teaches us mental flexibility. When I was a little girl, I went with my father to call on a wealthy farmer who had retired. All the time we were there, he complained about how unhappy he was. My father said to him, "Well, you have plenty of money, and you've never been anywhere. Why don't you travel and see the world?" I've never forgotten his reply. He said, "Why, John, I've worked all my life to get this money. I'm not going to spend it." Well, he needed to cultivate a little mental flexibility, didn't he? And so do we. We can all leave our customary habits of thought. You know, we're all slaves to our own thought patterns. We identify ourselves with them until we believe that's the way we are, rather than the way we think. Watch your thinking for a while, you'll see. You tend to think the same kind of thoughts over and over. And because we think the same kind of thoughts over and over, we express them. Then that's the way we seem to be. But we can all guide our thinking into new, fresh, spiritual habits of thought. And as we acquire these new spiritual habits of thought, our experience changes. Well, Abraham wasn't afraid to change his mind. He wasn't afraid to think differently than he'd ever thought before. When he perceived a spiritual idea, he embraced it, held on to it, and it blessed him beyond measure. Let's not be afraid to change our thinking radically from matter to spirit.
Let's accept spiritual ideas. Entertain them in consciousness. Follow where they lead. And enjoy the blessings they bring. Well, that's our first step in choosing heaven. An opening of thought to spiritual possibilities. Circumstances forced Moses to change his mind. But when he finally accepted the great fact that God is one omnipotent mind or soul, the source of identity and power, he had the moral courage to hold on to what he'd seen. All the suggestions of material-mindedness and all the arguments of material mentalism failed to pollute his thinking. His spiritual illumination was so potent and his fidelity to it so steadfast, he fulfilled his mission in spite of all efforts to dissuade him. He teaches us moral courage, spiritual steadfastness. And that's our second step in choosing heaven. It's holding fast to spiritual light and refusing the darkness of mental pollution. In this day of immediate communication, the mesmeric influence of polluting material-mindedness is strong. It takes active mental resistance to reject these mental pollutants, however widely they may be held, or however much they may seem to flood our thinking. And if this seems difficult to do, perhaps a very simple analogy will show us how easy it is. Let's imagine that you've just redecorated your living room. You know, fresh paint, lovely draperies, new carpet, and beautiful new upholstered furniture. It was all just as you wanted it. And one day you left your front door open, and a very dirty, muddy, stray dog ran in and began putting his muddy paws on your beautiful new furniture. What would you do? Just stand there wringing your hands and saying, "Oh dear, why did you come in and put your paws on my beautiful new furniture? How long are you going to stay?" Of course you wouldn't. You'd take him by the collar and put him out. Then you'd probably shut the door tightly this time. Well, that's exactly what we must do when polluting material suggestions rush in and defile our mental homes. Put them out quickly by bringing in more ideas of spiritual good, more ideas from God. This spiritual alertness will so harmonize our lives, we'll have frequent experiences of heaven here. And now we come to our indispensable third step in choosing heaven, selflessness. You know, sometimes we're tempted to turn away from this step because we think maybe we'll lose something we value. But instead, this is the step by which we gain the kingdom of heaven. Because you remember, when the Pharisees asked Jesus when the kingdom of heaven would come, he replied, "The kingdom of God cometh not with observation, neither shall they say, 'Lo here,' or 'Lo there.' For behold, the kingdom of God is within you." It's the expression of a true sense of selfhood as the outcome of God. Christ Jesus' selfless demonstration of God's rule in men's daily lives opens the way for us to choose heaven just as he did, by denying the material sense of self and acknowledging every man's Christly nature, our true selfhood, as the likeness of love. Jesus was the supreme example of spiritual selfhood humanly expressed. He identified himself with spirit completely and acknowledged only spiritual selfhood, the perfect outcome of God. We must follow his example as he said we could. Step by step, day by day, we must refuse to allow self-will, self-justification, self-love to govern us. We must reject self-condemnation, self-pity, self-righteousness, and all the many other forms of material self, so often polluting our thinking. And as we do this, moment by moment and day by day, the constant smog of material self and physical personality becomes thin enough so that the power of God and the law of God is expressed in our lives, bringing the healing and blessing of the Christ to ourselves and others, and leading us inevitably to our fourth and final step in choosing heaven, universal love. This is love understood and demonstrated as expressing the principle of all true being, divine love. Mary Baker Eddy's constant desire to share divine science with all men exemplifies for us this love and its human application. Universal love, spiritually understood and scientifically demonstrated, is the ultimate of the spiritual way. It's that for which everyone longs and with which everyone is satisfied. Why? Because in divine love is complete fulfillment and the healing of all the world's ills and anguish. The affluence of love eliminates poverty. The mercy of love heals injustice. The peace of love solves conflicts, and the nature of love destroys fear and hate. Divine truth, understood and demonstrated, divine love learned and lived, result in the spiritual harmony called heaven. The principle of life is divine love. The meaning of life is to live love. And the result of living love is heaven, now, here, and forever. Do you think I'm talking about utopia and forgetting that today men need bread? I'm not forgetting. But remember the words, man shall not live by bread alone. The many suicides today are not so much among people hungry for bread as among people starved for spiritual meaning in life. That young man who came to see me wasn't hungry for food, but he was so starved for spiritual answers he was contemplating suicide. He had come to matter's dead end. But spiritual light showed him the way to heaven, and now he's satisfied, and we all can be. As we cultivate mental flexibility, turning easily from matter to spirit, moral courage holding fast to spiritual light and refusing material pollution, total selflessness acknowledging all good from God alone, and universal love fulfilling the heart's desire. And as we see that these qualities are deeply rooted in the great facts of spiritual substance, spiritual selfhood, and ever-present divine love, then we know that life is spiritual, not material. It isn't just accidental physical existence. It's progressive spiritual unfoldment. Life isn't submission to an evil fate. It's spiritual dominion over the belief in fate. And life doesn't end in decay and death, because it's the eternal awareness of spiritual good. When we choose heaven, that's what life is to us, heaven. And it's what we can share with others. One day the telephone rang in the office of a Christian Science practitioner. A woman said that her husband was suffering a heart attack, and the symptoms sounded alarming. The practitioner assured the woman that the principle of life, divine love, and its spiritual law of present perfection, when understood and relied upon, heals disease. She quieted the woman's fear and told her to call back in an hour. Less than an hour later, the telephone rang, and it was the man himself. He said he was free from suffering and feeling completely normal. And he could hardly credit such a transformation, so he asked the practitioner if he should limit his activity or food. She replied, "Well, you say you're well. Why limit yourself?" So he asked her to pray for him until he could accept the fact of an instantaneous healing. She worked for him in Christian Science for another day, and by that time he knew he was permanently healed. And he knew a little more about heaven. He knew that it's health, not sickness. It's spiritual beauty, not material ugliness and longing. Heaven isn't tension and worry, fear and hate. That's hell. Heaven is peace, satisfaction, and love. But we have to choose it, don't we? And we have it only as we do this moment by moment and day by day. For we live in heaven as heaven lives in us. Thus we learn that heaven isn't just a future state, a place we can go carrying all our polluted mental baggage with us. It's a matter of continually rejecting the pollution of material fear, lack, hate, and constantly accepting the ever-present fact of divine life, truth, and love. It's holding on to them and demonstrating them until our lives conform to the spiritual fact. It's selflessly sharing our spiritual riches and blessings with others. And find it now in our human experience, and it shows to us our eternal being, because spiritual life is the eternally progressive experience of heaven. So heaven isn't a thing we wait for. It's a state we demonstrate according to the choices we make. Sometimes we're living in hell because we don't choose heaven, or because we're waiting for it in a future that never comes because we fail to choose it. But when we finally decide that we don't want to live any longer in the hell of material pollution and begin to choose heaven, we find ourselves progressively blessed with inner contentment and outer harmony. Our human needs are met. Strength and accomplishment go hand in hand. Human relationships become harmonious as a sense of material personal self is conquered. And universal love brings the sweet blessings of earth to attest our heaven here. And we find the answer to the question that man at the lecture raised. We are not just accidental entities staggering on materially from crisis to crisis. We're spiritual beings stepping forward spiritually from glory to glory. Mrs. Eddy has said, of two things fate cannot rob us, namely, of choosing the best and of helping others thus to choose. Let's choose the best. Let's choose heaven.
The members of First Church of Christ Scientist, Orinda, have brought you this taped Christian Science lecture by Grace Bemis Curtis, entitled Let's Choose Heaven Here. The next scheduled taped Christian Science lecture over KBRG will be April 5th at 2 p.m.